Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the forthcoming novel Brotherless Night.
And I'm Whitney Terrell, author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
So Whitney, have you ever had an encounter with a celebrity?
You mean besides you?
Ha ha!
Are we talking like before or after we started the podcast? Because we've had a lot of celebrities on the podcast, in my personal estimation. So, you know, we have to, are we, what's our time
nitpicking,
period?
Nitpicking. I'm talking before you and I started doing the show. Did you ever have an encounter with a celebrity and how did you act?
Well, if I did have an encounter, those were mostly in New York. I remember smoking a cigarette with Bruce Willis at a benefit for AMFAR, which was the American Foundation for AIDS Research, which my sister used to work for, and she was helping organize that benefit. And I also remember having dinner with my former editor at his favorite restaurant, and Paul Sorvino was sitting next to us, which was cool. I also once had dinner with Willem Dafoe and John Adams after a Russell Banks reading, which was, you know, interesting.
Okay. So you've met celebrities, and actually yeah. So have I, but how did you handle it?
Well, you pretend, you do the New York thing where you pretend like they're just some other person that you don't even recognize them. I said, Bruce asked me if I was a smoker at the time. He said, can I have a cigarette? And I said, sure. And we went outside and smoked a cigarette. We didn't even talk about moonlighting or anything. No Die Hard discussion.
Oh my God, what a missed opportunity. But anyway, exactly. So our guest for this episode is Abdelrazak Gurnah, who won the 2021 Nobel Prize for Fiction, for Literature. How are we going to handle talking to him? Because we've never had a Nobel Prize winner on the show before.
Do you think he smokes? Can we is that a way of breaking the ice?
No, I don't know. Maybe he does. But we cannot go outside and smoke with him without mentioning his amazing work, including his newest novel, Afterlives, which came out in the United States this August.
You're right, Sugi. And no offense to actors, but to me, being a Nobel Prize winner in literature is really one of the highest honors a person could ever achieve, so we're really lucky to have him here. Abdelrazak Gurnah is the 2021 winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature. He's the author of 9 previous novels, including Paradise, shortlisted for the Booker Prize, By the Sea, longlisted for the Booker Prize, and a finalist for the LA Times Book Award, and Desertion. Born and raised in Zanzibar, he is a professor emeritus of English and postcolonial literatures at the University of Kent. He lives in Canterbury, England. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
We're thrilled to have you with us. So just to set the historical context for Afterlives here, German East Africa was colonized by the Germans in 1885, and the Germans controlled a huge amount of territory, over 350,000 square miles, just territory that includes modern-day Rwanda and Burundi and Tanzania. And your novel references the Maji-Maji Rebellion of 1904 to 1905, but most of the book happens during battles between British and German forces in the lead-up to World War I and then also during that war. So for listeners who might not be familiar with that history, what was happening in East Africa then?
Well, what was happening was the aftermath of that conference in Berlin, where the European powers, as they like to call themselves, sat down together and drew up maps of the world, so which part of it belonged to them. So they divided up Africa between them, and Germany got what they called Deutsch Ostafrika, which is our part of the world. The British got what they called British East Africa, which is now Kenya, and so on. So they all went around doing that. But in reality, they really didn't own that much. So in order to make it work, particularly for the German state, they had to really invade these places. It really had to be a military conquest. And that's the period that I write about in Afterlife.
It also seemed like they didn't have that many soldiers there, that they needed to get recruit a lot of people to fight for them while they were there. Is that?
Well, that was also the practice. In fact, you know, there was something really quite important about European colonialism, both in Africa and India, but particularly in Africa, is that they did not want to see European people dying. So they did not want to have European soldiers around who could be seen to be actually vulnerable, even to a bullet. So in the case of the Schutztruppe, that is to say the colonial German army, the man appointed to carry out the conquest of this part of the world was a man called Colonel Bismarck. And what he did is he went and recruited mercenaries in Alexandria. These were mercenaries who had been used by the British in the conquest of the Mahdi in Sudan. But now they were no longer needed. So there they were, out of work. And he came along and said, okay, come work for me. So he took them and brought them to our part of the world. So the original Schutztruppe was a mercenary force made up of Nubian soldiers who were ex-British soldiers, ex-British mercenaries. So they had no compunction about whatever it was that their boss wanted them to do. They weren't dealing with people that they knew anything about. And this is the way in which colonial armies work. You recruit people, you take them to a place that has nothing to do with them, and you make them do all the ugliness that you don't want your people to be associated with. The same was true of the Belgian armies in Africa, the Force Publique. The same was true of the Portuguese armies. The same was true also of the British army, the King's African Rifles. So they all used African mercenaries.
That's so interesting.
Go ahead, Suki.
I'm just thinking as you talk about, I think probably the first time I saw a character like that depicted in fiction was in The English Patient with the Sapper Kip, who is so torn about being a part of British forces during World War II. And sort of, yeah, I think that was sort of the first time I had read a depiction like that. And I felt startled, even though those sorts of people had probably been in my own history, that I hadn't seen them on the page.
Sure, because the whole idea of the sepoy, the whole idea of the Indian defender of the East Indian Army is just a mercenary force to suppress other India. This is just a continuation of that method of running or of organizing colonial armies. Because it was so late in the day for Germany was so deeply militarized, the state, they could not conceive of anything other than just crush, crush, crush. It's not, I don't think, necessarily in the mind of Germans to always do this. It's simply that was the state mentality.
And of course, you have two important characters in the book who are East African who end up fighting with the Germans. And we're going to talk about them a little bit later in the interview. You were born in Zanzibar in 1948, years after the events described in the book. So what was the political and economic climate like there when you were growing up compared to the world that the characters inhabit in Afterlives?
Different in some ways, similar in other ways. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to kind of evoke it as it were. So there are some aspects of it which were still familiar. The small town, the small trader. My father was one of those. So I was familiar with that kind of shop, smallness, and how people live very close together like that. But I was also familiar with the stories of the war, both from, in a kind of personal way, because of family members who had participated in that in one way or another, either as conscripts or volunteers. My uncle volunteered for the KAR for the Second World War. So I was familiar with this idea of joining into colonial armies and wondering, and he was very proud of it. There was a wonderful photograph of him, which my mother, his sister, had on a stand in a house, wearing his uniform. The hat that I had, but nonetheless, he was an extremely intelligent man who actually ended up being the director of education in Zanzibar after many tribulations. So he wasn't kind of a ragamuffin, whatever. He was somebody who was ambitious. And so just in some ways, the colonial army actually seemed like a destination for ambitious young people. That was one way in which you associated yourself with the prestige of the conqueror, the prestige of the new, of the modern, of technology, armaments, of language.
Right. And then some of your characters are attracted to this as well. And in your Nobel Prize acceptance speech, you said, and I'm quoting here, we were those of our generation, children of colonialism in a way that our parents were not, and nor were those who came after us, or at least not in the same way. We grew up and were educated in that period of high imperial confidence, at least in our parts of the world, when domination disguised its real self in euphemisms and we agreed to the subterfuge. And there are some scenes in the book where I just was thinking about that. And I want to talk about that idea of domination disguising itself in subterfuge, especially in the context of characters like Ilyas and Hamza, who choose to join the German army. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that and maybe read a section of the book for us.
Yeah, I'd be happy to read a section of the book and also to talk about that.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
I mean, it's a familiar thing. It's a familiar thing in all conquered cultures, if you like, or all conquered society. The attraction and the prestige associated with the conqueror, the opportunities that opens up. I mean, if you are one of the defeated, what are you going to do? Are you going to stay with that lot, or are you going to... And then all those lovely uniforms that you can wear as a result of being the authority it gives you in your society and so on. There are all sorts of, and the money. You get paid to do this work. I think you have to be able to either be self-assured in what you believe, which a lot of people are, of course, a lot of people manage to just hang on and say, I don't want anything to do with it. You have to be self-assured, or you have to be not in need, or you have to be maybe a little bit older and wiser to say, I don't want anything to do with it. But the schools are open. Bring your children to us. We will teach them. And what we will teach them will actually ultimately teach them to despise themselves, unless something else happens. And something else did happen, because the 1,000-year right of colonialism did happen. So it was possible for this process to end very quickly. And it's only really through the period of decolonization in the 90s, for me anyway, and for people of my generation, it's only in that period that people were actually able to step back from it and say, hey, watch, we don't want these people anymore. How do we cope with ourselves? And it opened minds, even young people, about what had been going on, instead of the mollifying stories that, for a place like ours. In other places, in Kenya, for example, there were no mollifying stories. There was the emergency. And so there were killings and imprisonments and concentration camps. So it would have been different there. But for a small place like us, it was kind of possible to be drawn along that, it's all right. Here you are, go to school, learn this, learn that. And I think it was decolonization that actually made it possible to say, no, this is no good. We don't want this anymore. Do you want me to read some?
Yes, please.
It was difficult to tell how long they stood to attention in the late morning sun. A quarter of an hour, maybe. But after some time, Umbasha Haider returned and instructed Abudu to follow him while Hamza remained standing in the exercise of dance. Then it was his turn. And he marched ahead of the Umbasha as instructed up to the open door of the office, where he was momentarily blinded by the deep shade. Harain, a voice spoke from within. It was the first time he had heard the officer's voice. and Hamza felt its severity through his sinews. He stepped into a large office with two windows at the front and a desk at the end facing the door. There was a chair in front of the desk and another small table set against the wall on which stood a draftsman board. The officer was sitting behind the desk, leaning back in his chair. His face was leaner without his helmet, and there was a wrinkle of the skin on his left upper cheek and temple below the hairline. His eyes were a piercing blue. After a long, deliberate silence, the officer spoke in German, and the Umbasha translated. The Oberleutnant asked if you want to be signaled. Yes, sir, Hamza said loudly, addressing the air above the officer's head and speaking with as much conviction as he could. He did not know if being a signalman was any safer than being an askari, but it was not the moment to quibble. The officer spoke again briefly. Why? The Umbasha translated. Hamza had not thought of an answer to this question, although he should have done. After a moment's thought, he said, to learn a new skill and to serve the Schutztruppe as well as I can. He glanced quickly at the officer and saw that he smiled. It was Hamza's first sight of the sneer he would come to know well. Can you read? The Umbasha translated again. I can read a little. The officer made an interrogative face, asking him to clarify. Hamza did not know how to add to that. He knew all the letters and with patience could make up words if they were in Kiswahili. He was not sure if that was what the officer wanted to know. So he stared above his head and said nothing. The officer spoke in German, speaking slowly and looking at the Umbasha, who waited until he had finished and then translated. The words came out in the newbie's usual mangled style, and because Hamza stood facing the officer, he saw in the edge of his vision that he winced slightly at times at the Umbasha's excesses. It was said the officer spoke the best Kiswahili of all the Germans. The Oberleutnant say, why you don't learn more to read? Why you don't read everything like he can? Everything you put in front of you, code. And you don't learn. You have no civilization. That is why you savage. He says you must learn. What word he say? Vesatic, something like that. You don't know that. Mathematics, the officer said. Yes. Mathematic. You don't know that, you kelp, you savage dog, the Umbasha said. Nini jina la mathematics kwa lugha yako? The officer asked, doing without the Umbasha after all. What is the word for mathematics in your language? Do you know what mathematics is? You can't understand anything of the world's learning without mathematics. Not music or philosophy, let alone the mechanics of signaling. Unafahamu? Ndio bwana, Hamza said loudly. You don't even know what mathematics is, do you? We have come here to bring you this, mathematics, and many other clever things that you would not have without us. This is our civilization mission. The officer said, and then gestured with his left arm towards the window at the bomber outside, his lean face and his thin lips creased in a sardonic smile. This is our cunning plot, which only a child could misunderstand. We have come here to civilize. Nafam, dear boy,
So I'm especially thrilled to have you here because I reviewed your last novel, Gravel Heart, for the New York Times when it came out in 2017. I did.
Oh,
and
yes.
I just loved it.
Wonderful person.
I love that book. It was so, so great. I have a lot of family in London, most of them immigrants from Sri Lanka. And I had never read a book that reflected, I felt so beautifully, the texture of that life. And I so admired the pacing of the book. It's slow burn, which seems really to be a hallmark of your style. And Ilyas and his younger namesake in Afterlives remind me somewhat of Salim in Gravel Heart. And their situations kind of remind me that migration may require not only separation from family, but the constant decision to return or not to return, which is a question your characters always seem to be asking themselves to find out or not to find out. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the separation and reunification of families in your work and how you think about depicting that in relation to colonialism.
Well, colonialism is part of it, of course, because it's what created the habit that makes it seem, you know, other places more desirable than others. But it's always been, to me, it's always been a question that I have debated constantly. What to do? Stay, go, stay, go. Is it best to stay? Is it best to go? And how people benefit from either of those two experiences. I tried to write about that in Desertion, for example, but you know, you always have other things. You can't kind of stick it to a simple idea. Novels are always seductive in that way. You sort of start with an idea and it just leads you in different directions. And so it's not just simply about whether it's right to stay or what is the best thing to do, stay, go, stay, go. But I think it's always a question worth revisiting. Especially as new generations come on, is it best for you to stay there and do what you can? Or is it better for you to leave and go and find somewhere else? Because when you do that, there's usually no way back, really, in the end. So when you do that, when you encourage your younger relatives to say, come over here, we'll send you to school or something like that, then that's it. Quite a lot of the time, that's it. They don't come back. Which means parents get left behind, which means people get old and there's nobody around to be with them, and so on. And also there's nobody there to do whatever injection of energy and intelligence it requires to allow places. I say this now, but it's always been a thought that has concerned me more or less from the moment I arrived in it. So, what have I done? Is this the right thing? You know, you can't answer those questions. What you, this is your life now. Just get on with it. But sure, I admire people who can find a way, like some of them actually have. Say, okay, I'm going back, and I'll do what I can.
I think one of the things I appreciate that you don't depict it as linear, right? Your characters seem to go back and forth, also. Mm-hmm. Like Afia is an interesting example, or I mean, even, you know, you yourself have gone quote unquote home since winning
several
the Nobel
times.
Prize.
Yeah.
So it
but,
doesn't seem
so
like
it still means that you actually can't make that. You know, there's something, this is the bind about migration. You know, you have to wait till you can go back and say, yep, it was worth it. It was worth it. All the misery and pain are worth it. But by then, you've probably got 3 children, got a mortgage, you got a job, you got this. So it's actually not possible to go back, you know, because what can you go back to do when you've got a full life here? And if you're lucky, that is, that's how it happens. If you're not lucky, nothing like that happens. And you continue still struggling. And how can you say, here I am, I'm back, it was worth it, but I'm worth nothing? So this is also the bind of migration. When you leave, you make an investment in life. Your life. You invest your life. I'm doing this. Whatever misery I'm causing you, I'm doing this because I'm going to go there. I'm going to make something. If you don't make something, you really essentially cannot go back. And by the time you make something, it's too late. Because you made something there. And going back doesn't work.
Thank you so much for your time. We want to remind our listeners to go out and pick up a copy of Afterlives, which is out now in the United States. And we appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Anne Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!